I used to see talks and people would be like, oh yeah, and then I did this great job and then I did that, and you'd always be like, how?
Yeah.
For me, it was always, came out of uni in the biggest recession we've had, I think, since the 80s, 2008. It's one of those just days where everything changes. So I was on the bus on the way to the job centre to sign on and got the phone call that I got this job. We won the Rio Olympics advertising, and it was Visa were the sponsors, so Visa were the client. We won that bit of work and it was amazing. One of the biggest lessons I've learned is it was very often the case that we would work till 2 a.m, 3 a.m, sometimes all night to get these jobs done.
And was it tough on your mental?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure I've ever quite recovered from...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, how kind of mental it was. So for me, it was... I mean, I have anxiety now, for sure. I think what I did... I feel like I did well was learn from every time that we didn't win something and try and question why that didn't happen. And so I realised, and I think a lot of design studios do this, which is great for me now because we don't do it, is...
If there's one thing I've learned from this conversation, it's the power of... Today's guest shows the power of going out and taking what is yours. Gordon Reed is the owner of creative agency Middle Boob that has worked with some of the world's leading brands, including Adidas, HSBC, Unilever, and so many more. Today, he takes us through his entire journey from working in advertising to illustration to founding his agency and so much more. Guys, this is one you do not want to miss. It shows you that nothing is impossible and the power is within you. Now, enjoy the show. Hi guys, welcome to another episode of What My Best Friend Does, where we talk to best friends in the hope of inspiring you to take immediate action to find the career of your dreams. Guys, today I'm joined by the creative agency owner, Gordon. How you doing?
I'm very well, thanks, Bayer. Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
My pleasure. Welcome to the show. We like to start with a little icebreaker.
Okay.
What did you want to be growing up?
So, what did I want to be growing up? I wanted to be a film director.
Did you?
Yeah, I actually did. Yeah, it's... It's something, it was interesting. I remember so clearly, I was at school and maybe year 8, year 9, something like that. And they made us stand up one by one and say, what do you want to be when you grow up? And people were just standing up going, you know, I don't know. I can't remember that. I want to be a footballer.
Yeah,
I want to be the classic. And people were like, oh, you know, I want to work in an office or I want to follow what my dad does or something like that. Something actually quite like achievable. And I loved film. You know, I loved animation. I loved film. So I said I wanted to be a film director. And everyone laughed.
Mm.
Even the teacher laughed. And I remember thinking, this doesn't seem that unachievable, you know?
Yeah.
So that was quite... I've always had that with me, yeah.
Yeah, wow. So it's funny there. So you've always had a little bit of an eye, always had a thought to be creative. So yeah, let's take it back. Like, have you always been creative, and what has your journey been like to this point?
Yeah, I think I have. I reckon I have. So my journey was, if we're starting right back from school, I never quite got on with what was going on at school.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely moved, I was siding towards being media studies, English, more of the creative fields, art. Terrible at design technology, which is interesting. Something wasn't quite clicking at school. We didn't have those options to kind of do anything more creative than art. And I was a bit disillusioned with art at the time because, strangely, my work got thrown away before my GCSE results, which is quite funny. And I remember my art teacher, who was really lovely up until this point, she said, as I was leaving the room, quite stressed, she went, well, it can't have been very good, your work, if I threw it away.
Oh, my goodness. Just what every 15-year-old wants to hear.
Yeah. So it was one of those things. So I was pushed into doing A-levels at the time just because I had no clue on the direction at the time. And again, it was like media studies, English, IT. So if you combine those three, you pretty much get graphic design, creative, marketing. But hated it. Absolutely hated it at the time.
Wow.
Uh, it just wasn't really gelling with me. And it was only until about a year later I was working in a pub. And
so no uni for you, just straight into work?
Well, yeah, I was working from 15. I was working in a pub at 15. Wow. So I've been working for, over 20 years now. Yeah. God.
How time flies.
Yeah. Doesn't it just? Yeah. So, and I met these two guys that were studying at an art college really near me, that they were doing graphic design. And I saw what they were doing. I thought, I just never really comprehended that you could do that for a career, kind of applying art in such a kind of material and tangible way. So thankfully was able to get onto an art college course at this place. I mean, I turned up, I didn't have a portfolio. I didn't know what a portfolio was particularly. I just had a folder of things that I'd made, pretty much. Collage work and things like that interested me. And thankfully the teacher at the time saw enough in it to go, we'll give you a chance.
Give you a place. Okay, so you get to art college, and how long do you spend there?
2 years. Two of the best years of my life. Met my friends for life, who were all a bit disillusioned like me, trying to find their way. And it was brilliant. It was Epsom Art College, which was actually a 10-minute walk from my house. Mm-hmm. Was ironically, my school was about an hour's bus ride, which is quite funny. And we just did everything. We just experimented with stuff for 2 years. Drank a lot in the local Wetherspoons, and realised that design was that thing that I felt like I was quite good at. I suppose I've always been fairly, to answer your question, I've always been fairly creative in different ways. It just took a little while to click with what I wanted to do.
And a chance encounter. Like seeing the people whilst working at the pub. But like on that, so you mentioned the fact that you do 2 years in college. You've obviously cut your teeth, learnt some new skills. What happens from that point? Like, do you start to understand like the different career pathways there are and potential jobs you can get?
Not at that point, no. So I did go to university after college. Yeah, okay. I went to a very dodgy uni that was a polytechnic. And I think it was the first year that it become like a proper.
It's so funny that you say this. So I know what uni you went to, and I went to the sister university.
Get out.
Yeah. So by the way, we're just talking in codes. So Gordon went to Southampton Solent, and I went to Uni of Southampton. yeah. But yeah, sorry, continue.
No, that's it. Yeah. How was your experience there?
I loved it. I loved it. And I think... it's one of the reasons for this podcast, because when I went to Southampton University, before then, I was a homebody. Okay. And I only knew what was in, you know, a 5-mile radius of where I lived. But going to university, it exposed me to different cultures, different lifestyles, different career paths. Like, I didn't know what a year abroad was before I went to university. I didn't know what Bali was. So I went, and it expanded. Sometimes you don't know what you don't know. Yeah. And there was a lot I didn't know. So for me, university was great at expanding my horizons. What about you?
Well, Southampton will definitely expand your horizons, that's for sure. Yeah. God. It is quite the place.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like, you know. So my experience was interesting at uni. It wasn't... So I really wanted to do graphic design as a course. And they ended up putting me onto more of a digital-based course, which it never really sat well with me, because I just wanted to do like letter pressing and screen printing and really old school kind of sort of tactile types of design. And they were more about, let's learn this program, let's learn Flash, if you remember Flash, or Dreamweaver, all of these products that are now completely, you know, defunct. Uni was tough, actually, and it took a while to get to know a good group of people that I could hang with. So, but it really taught me early on that you've got to, if you want something bad enough, if you want this career, if you want to do this full time, then no one else is going to do it.
Mm.
My lecturers were great in the end, but I had to really show them that I may not be ticking the boxes you need to give me good grades, but like I really want to be a designer. Like I really want to learn. And they were quite impressed when they found out I was in the library quite a lot, just using the resources there to learn about the history of famous designers and how things became
how they came to be.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so that kind of changed the tune a little bit, but really, yeah, the biggest learning was I've got to do this myself and I've got to find a way to, like, my lecturers aren't going to sort me out a job. They have no connections. Southampton, no one's going to come to Southampton to see your final year show, or my parents didn't have connections in design. You know, there weren't really any avenues that I could lean on to progress my career.
So I hear that, but do you feel like maybe the friends that you made at university, were they like from your course, and were you looking at what they were doing, seeing if potentially you could get a job with one of them, or no, just no option?
Well, that's a really good point. So at uni, no, I don't know it. I'm not in touch with many of them now. I don't think one guy went on to do quite well. We actually started working together on something post-uni. But generally, yeah, I think most of the guys that I knew, certainly on my course, I'm not sure if they're even...
Still in the field.
But I met a guy who's now one of my best friends still. Brilliant guy, brilliant designer. He's an author. He does all sorts of cool stuff. So at my final... So I worked for Solent Uni as well, by the way, because I had no money. And they offered jobs like tour guides.
Yeah.
So you could go and tour students around the university. And one day they phoned me up and said, we're doing a photo shoot and we need someone who looks like a graphic designer. So I'm like, I guess that's me. do you want to be in this shoot? And it was like 50 quid, which I dearly needed. So I said, yeah, that sounds really fun. And the guy who was... suppose directing the shoot and subsequently doing the campaign, which was an out-of-home campaign in Southampton, it was quite big at the time, was my friend Radim, who I met. And he was the first guy. He was like, in Southampton, he was, as you know, it's quite a tight-knit, small community. You've got your guys working on the docks, you've got the students, yeah. You've got a few people in between. It's kind of a weird place. But he was sort of the big fish in the small pond. So at the time, he was getting a lot of design press, but also he would do posters for like all of the clubs in Southampton.
Lots of posters, bloody hell.
Lots of posters,
yeah.
Lots of clubs. I'm not gonna name them.
Yeah.
So he was like this sort of big fish in a small pond, and I really sort of looked to that as like, God, if he can kind of do this, then... So he helped me out a lot early doors, you know, great advice. Even got me working for him on a few projects, certainly early on. So I could kind of, like you say, cut my teeth on actually working on a project that was a little bit more commercial. Again, 50 quid, I think he paid me at the time. It's always 50 quid.
Yeah. Before like the inflation we're going through at the moment, it went a long way.
75, exactly, 75 quid now.
Yeah. But yeah, so you go to university, you said it's a more digital-based course, but it sounds like from everything you've experienced, you knew that you were leaning more towards like graphic design. Yeah. As like the profession. When you finish university or during university, how is it you go about securing that work with like your friend and any other bits you got at that time?
This is really interesting because we came out of uni in the biggest recession we've had, I think, since the 80s, 2008. Mm. So there were no jobs. I mean, it was, you were looking at jobs boards for creative industries, any sort of design, nothing.
Wow.
Or like really very few. And my portfolio, because of the way that the course was and because of the way that I rebelled against the course, I just kind of did work that interested me. And it got to that point where I knew I wasn't really going to get good grades for it, but I was practicing work that I enjoyed, and in the end, that's done me well. So it was one of those instances where I'm kind of looking at it going, my work's not commercial enough or sellable enough to a design studio that even if I got an interview for those few jobs, I just wouldn't get it. So it was kind of a strange time, but for me, it goes back to at that time, you have, first of all, the arrogance of youth, right? So it's like, I'm going to do this and I'll do it myself. Mm-hmm. And if I have to, and I'll just keep going. And I remember, you know, certain people who they weren't particularly in creative, but they would say, you know, go and work somewhere for free for a bit, just learn the ropes. And I remember thinking, I'm not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually, you know, really good advice, by the way. So I was very stubborn. But for me, I loved music. And I'd just been to a festival where, actually got to know the guys who run it. And the whole premise of the festival was everyone's on the same level. There was kind of no backstage area or anything like that. So you'd walk around and you'd meet some of your idols or just great musicians. And it broke down a bit of a foundation, a bit of a wall for me, where I realized, like, I can just approach people and suggest doing some artwork for them.
Mm.
And so that's what I did. That first year, the first couple of years, worked in a shop, like a frozen food shop in my town, just to make ends meet. And in the evening, I would create artwork for musicians. And how I did that was I literally would just email people. I'd just, anyone, bands managers, PR agents, sometimes the artist. I'd just say, look, I'm doing these screen prints, these illustrations. How about I do some screen prints for you? I think I noticed a bit of a disconnect between... So in the American market, gigs, screen prints are huge. And bands will go on tour and they'll sell these amazing pieces of art.
Mm-hmm.
But that culture, that screen print culture, hadn't really come over here. So people weren't really selling posters much at gigs in UK tours. So it was kind of a thing where a fair amount of bands were quite appreciative of me just offering to do it.
Free of charge.
Free of charge,
start.
Yeah.
And then 50 quid.
And then 50 quid, yeah. No, it was, you know what? It was always free of charge. And some bands just let me sell it on the merch stand. And so I'd take money from that. Some bands, rightfully so, would want a cut from it. Some, when the gigs got bigger and we were going to kind of 2,000, 3,000 capacity venues, the amount of money... You'd have to pay that venue a percentage for selling merch,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting. I didn't know this until I was there. So you'd always have to give a percentage back. But yeah, so I would do things like that. And then you start to make contacts within that sort of world. So it really was early on, it was just trying to do things.
That's really entrepreneurial, can I just say? Because I don't know how many people would think, I'm going to email everybody, I'm going to send them. So when you're emailing like the PR people, the people from the bands, are you sending them like, this is what a poster for you would look like? Or were you sending them examples of work that you'd done previously? Because I'm just thinking, like, to people who are listening to this, how is it they could go about potentially like securing that internship or that opportunity? Should they tailor it to the person they're targeting, or should they just share their portfolio of work based on what they've already done?
It's a good question. So I'm trying to think of what I would do then.
Or what would you do now?
Well, yeah. Now I'd send them a portfolio.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever suggested this is what I could do for you. It really was. I mean, it was so casual. Again, that arrogance of youth, just like, of course they're going to want a poster. It's almost like just believing, like, why wouldn't they?
Mm-hmm.
So, it really was quite, I was probably far too over casual with the way I email people.
Sometimes ignorance is bliss. And then obviously you mentioned the fact that you're working in a frozen food shop at the same time to make ends meet. Like, where is the moment where design can actually become your main source of income and you can leave the rest, the other jobs behind?
So this was couple of years in. I was doing a lot of editorial illustration work as well, and it was like, so I was really trying to balance day job and kind of move away from that. And again, with press, by the way, this is probably a good point before we move on, was I used to, with the music, with the artwork, I would send a copy of the prints to, I used to go to Smith's, W.H. Smith's, or any place that had magazines. There used to be loads of graphic design magazines. And I just, you could get the names of all of the art editors and the people working for the magazine, like in the front cover. And so I'd get the address and would always send prints to these guys and follow up with a phone call maybe a few days later. And I mean, I wouldn't dream of doing that now. It's so funny, like the things that you do.
But this is like pre-Google, right? Pre-websites.
I'm not that old.
Okay, so yeah. Oh, no, sorry, I'm thinking too fast. It's like pre-Instagram.
Yeah.
So sorry, which is where a lot of people put like a lot of their work now. Sorry, yeah, you're not. Sorry,
no, it's all good. It's all good. No, it's very much pre-Instagram. Yeah.
I can't believe I said that. Nah.
Yeah, there was a dictaphone and... it was pre-Instagram, so it was to promote your work at that stage was very different.
Yeah,
probably easier because I still can't imagine that many people were doing what I was doing.
Yeah,
but because of those channels just weren't available. You would have to be a bit more creative, I suppose, with how you connected to people. But that opened loads of doors for me doing that. Speaking to editors, getting to know them a little bit, kind of what they were all about, and so then when I was doing a certain project, I used to do zines as well.
What is a zine?
Good question. Yeah. A zine. So it's a magazine. It's an A5 magazine that you publish yourself.
Okay.
So they were really famous in, I think, the '70s, in the punk era. So you would get, they would scan in these like punk magazines. It was kind of a thing that people were into, and we just took it on a bit more and put a bit of money into the printing for it, so it was quite a nice cover. And I used it as a tool to meet people that I really wanted to meet. So I figured that, similar with the podcast now, you, if there's someone that you want to meet, especially in our industry, creative people like talking about their career and what they do, and thought, well, maybe I could offer them an interview in the zine, and then we can develop a relationship like that. And so that always worked. You know, we interview bands and artists and designers and all sorts from there. So it was all these early mechanisms to get to know people, get to know how to talk to press, get to know how to introduce yourself to designers and creatives and peers. That helped.
And then we take all of those learnings, and then you mentioned a couple of years in, you're able to make it your full-time career.
Yeah.
Like, what's the moment that allows for you to leave the frozen food shop behind?
I can't believe I'm talking. So this was obviously really interesting time. I had a friend of mine, his wife worked for a stag do company, which is when you have their USP was, if you have a best man who's too lazy to organize it all himself, you go to these companies, they sort it out. It was a very weird place. And she worked there in sales, I think. And I was working in the shop. And it was about that time where my parents were starting to say, maybe this design thing isn't quite working for you. You should look at something else, and which wasn't particularly great advice, by the way. And I was thinking, well, you know, where do I go from here? And she basically phoned me up one day and said, they need a designer. Would you like to interview for it? So interviewed for it. Walked into the frozen food shop about a week later. They let me go. It was a really strange day. It's one of those just days where everything changes. So I was on the bus on the way to the job centre to sign on, and got the phone call that I got this job.
Oh, amazing. So amazing.
It was, okay, cool.
Yeah.
So that was really the day, and that was the day that I could finally trade properly as a designer. And it was a terrible job. So I had to borrow a laptop because I didn't have money to buy a proper Mac. And I had to borrow my friend's old Mac, which had like the battery was bulging because the battery was going to break and blow up. And it was crazy. And they wouldn't pay for any gear. And I worked in this stag do company doing infographics, which are no longer a thing. And it was really toxic as an environment. It was my first, it was like on Wells Street, just off of Oxford Street. So for me, it was kind of literally going from living in Surrey in this little town to commuting and working in, you know, the bright lights.
And you mentioned it was toxic. What made that first experience so toxic?
Oh my God, it was a terrible place to work. I don't know if you've ever worked in sales or around sales.
Yeah, people. Yeah, that's what I do. Yeah.
You do sales, yeah. But you do good sales. Yeah, digital sales.
Yeah.
These guys were doing shots at like 9 a.m. on a Monday.
Oh really?
Yeah, it was terrible. The owner was a proper boozer. I mean, it was just
a horrible environment to be part of.
It was really crazy.
Was it worth it for at least getting the experience and like building out your experience?
Oh my god, definitely. Yeah, because I think at that point really I hadn't worked to a brief for someone who isn't creative, who doesn't really know how to brief a creative. You know, most of my work, if not all of it, had been either self-initiated at that point or at the very least briefed by someone who knows how to work with a creative. So this was like my first, I suppose, corporate environment, working with people who just, they needed stuff quickly. You needed to churn through things. So kind of, I learned a lot about learning about how to manage expectations with people like that.
Mm-hmm. So I know from like looking at your background, obviously 2008 happens, Middle Boot, which is like the agency that you founded, I think you found it in 2009. So like this job and the subsequent jobs, are you like a contractor or were you working for the organization? And yeah, talk to me about the origins of setting up your agency and why you did it.
Nice. So I was a contractor for a long time. After this job, I did freelance advertising for years. And again, at the time, I really wanted to Middle Boot to be illustration. And that's what I wanted to be known for. So it was double hatting again, but in a different sense. So in the daytime, I would go in and be a freelance designer in all of these different advertising agencies, learnt what not to do, what to do, how to be. And in the evening, I would do illustration.
And sorry to just jump in there. Can you talk to me, like, all right, as a designer in advertising, what are the various roles that you can do? And what did your days and weeks look like working in advertising?
Nice. So the roles that you can do really as a designer or a creative in advertising, you've got, so the tiers generally go, you've got creative and their creative team. So there'll usually be a copywriter and an art director, and they will come up with the conceptual work for ads, all the ads that you see on TV and bus posters. Mm-hmm. And then they'll work usually with a couple of designers, maybe a head of design, and then we'll work with art workers who then, so we take the, usually, I mean, people talk about briefing. Briefing in advertising very rarely exists. It's honestly, you know, you hear these stories about someone that they'll sketch something out on a napkin or something. I mean, the amount of times I had, you know, I remember one ad, a guy came to me stinking of booze, like, and it's not the only time this happened. And he gets this piece of paper, and it was a car ad. I think it was for Nissan or someone like that. And he's sketching this thing out, and it's like, yeah, we want the car here, and we want the Loch Ness monster over there, and we want. And it's just these scribbles on this bit of paper. And I'm like,
what is that?
The hell do you want me to do with that?
Yeah.
You know, you can design that up, can't you? But that was our life. So a lot of our work was, we call it comping, which is where you comp together an ad. So you would take maybe some stock imagery or some photography that had been done and kind of build a piece on Photoshop or a program like that. And what that comping does is it sells in the advertising to the client. So then the creatives and sometimes us will then be in the meeting with a client and we'll go, here's our dream of your dog food ad, you know, or whatever it is. And you hope that they buy it. So yeah, design can really vary actually. So for those thinking of going into a design career, you can move into art direction or creative as well. Yeah, it's quite a varied role.
So you've got art direction, you've got creative, graphic design. Okay.
And then art working is more of the end of the line production. So that's when a designer maybe would have come up with an ad, or certainly me a few times. Things are a little bit rough around the edges. Maybe the logo needs a bit of tweaking or the copy needs a bit of alignment. Mm-hmm. The art workers will do everything and get it like print ready or ready to be on TV. And then you've got the digital side as well. So you've got all the digital creatives who work more in that space, which is an UX.
And from like your time working in advertising, were there any campaigns that you briefed in that were successful that really stood out and that you're proud of?
Yeah, tons. I'm really happy with that time in my life. Like, I'm glad to have left it behind too, for various reasons. Yeah, yeah. We'll get into, I think. But so for me, it's interesting. Like, I walked past the building yesterday. I worked at Saatchi & Saatchi for 3 years, okay, maybe a bit more, as a freelancer. So that's a great gig in itself. And it was when we still had the old building on Charlotte Street, which is where a lot of very famous advertising had been created in the 70s and 80s. And it's kind of where advertising was born in a lot of ways. There's obviously a few more Ogilvy's and a few more big agencies that did it, but they were the big guys, early doors anyway. So to work there, you're kind of part of a bit of history. And it was like a dusty old schoolhouse style building where it's just like notebooks and paper everywhere. It was a big mess, but it was chaos. But like, you embrace if you learn to embrace the chaos at a place like that, you kind of get by. Mm-hmm. And we did some really cool ads. We did a big one for me that I was singing from the rooftops of. At the time was we won the Rio Olympics.
Oh, wow.
Advertising.
Oh, wow.
And it was, I think it was 2016, so nearly 10 years ago, which is crazy.
Mm.
Time flies. And it was Visa were the sponsors, so Visa were the client. We won that bit of work, and it was amazing. There was a great team, one of my best friends now, who was the creative on it. And it did really well. It was like a global campaign. So you had huge posters like all over the world advertising this thing. And there was a TV ad. It was very conceptual. It was all based around a heart. So we had all these different ads. They were 3D rendered and designed. And it was all about the heart of the Olympian never stops beating. Mm-hmm. And I think it was like, I can't remember the line for Visa. It was a bit of a wanky line.
Like, yeah.
The heart of Visa never stops working, or it was better than that.
Yeah, yeah.
But so that was cool. And I learned some great stuff there. And there were days where because for me at the time, I'd done a lot of layout design for advertising for different ads. And this was more art directional, the role. So it meant that I'd be running down into Soho, into some of the production houses and telling the guys doing the 3D rendering kind of how to do the shading on these images and how to get them together. And there was even an emergency where, again, this is before like Dropbox was as big as it is. And we had a problem where we sent the files to Greece. I think it was Greece. They could not download the files because they were so big.
Mm.
So there was a point where It's like, the only solution is I'm going to have to get on a plane and fly to Greece with a floppy disk. Not floppy disk. Not, again, not that old.
Yeah.
Hard drive.
Yeah.
And give them the files manually to upload these ads so that they can design.
Wow.
It was crazy. It was a crazy time.
Yeah. And like, you know, working on a project like that, like what were some of the challenges? And like you mentioned the fact that, yeah, like I'm sure it's not all roses, right? What is like the work-life balance like and the advertising culture like?
I feel like that's a loaded question.
Only because of what you said earlier.
Oh, like, yeah, that's true. Yeah. it's terrible. I mean, it was terrible. The work-life balance. I mean, it's why I'm... So I am not long after... I mean, I was in my 20s at Saatchi. I was single. And then I met my now wife while I was there. But it was... So you could get away with doing long nights. But it was very often the case that we would work till 2 a.m., 3 a.m., sometimes all night to get these jobs done. And that particular job, Visa, in fact, I hadn't heard of this term before, basically a night designer. And what that was I would do my normal day shift, maybe leave about 7, something like that, and someone else would come in overnight and continue working.
Wow.
So this was when we were pitching for the work. So it was basically there was a continuous 24-hour production of design, which I'm not sure I've heard of since, actually. But yeah, it was really tough. And then you come in the morning and all of your files would be a mess because someone else had worked on them. And there would be someone breathing down your neck going, we've got a meeting in 10 minutes. And I'm, yeah, I mean.
Was it tough on your mental?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I've ever quite recovered from.
Oh wow!
Yeah, how kind of mental it was. So for me, it was, yeah. I mean, I have anxiety now for sure. I mean, I must have always had it, but it was at that time I was starting to realize, like, God, I can't do this forever. This is full on. So you just get these moments where, I mean, I've seen some crazy shit in advertising. I've been working and seen a woman just come downstairs and like throw a keyboard across the room and start shouting at someone.
Really?
Yeah, because like a logo wasn't quite aligned or, you know, stuff that is just completely unacceptable in a working environment, and it's not conducive to doing good work.
Not that that's ever acceptable. Was the pay, like, do you feel like you were at least rewarded, like, or compensated adequately for the long hours in this environment?
Well, it certainly wasn't 50 quid,
okay.
For sure.
Yeah.
Those days were gone. But yeah, I mean, the pay was good, especially as a freelancer. You could, I always felt that I wanted to do this on my own as much as I could. And I got offered full-time jobs, and I never felt that the rates were particularly worth the effort and the hours that you put into that sort of job. Mm-hmm. Like, you've got to really love advertising to do it. And I did for a while, but it did get to the point where there was no more wiggle room with the money. And I was getting into my 30s, and I was settling down with my wife and thinking, well, we might want to have kids. And you look around and you think, well, so where do I go from here? I could try and be a freelance head of design. Most of those guys I know are divorced because they're never home. Not all of them, but you're looking like there were so many times where we'd be working late on an ad and you'd hear the head of design phoning his, oh, I'm going to be late again, you know, are you okay putting the kids to bed? Just thinking, I don't want this. Like, I feel like, you know, by that point we're thinking, well, it'd be nice to have a mortgage.
Mm.
It'd be nice to kind of do all of those things.
So question, so this is like 10 years ago, so hopefully it's okay. As a freelance graphic designer, what would your rate be roughly, if you could give us a range?
Okay, so 10 years ago, 300 a day.
Okay, we take that.
Yeah.
That's 1.5 a month. That's 1.5 a week.
1.5 a week plus VAT.
Yeah, 6.
1.8 a week.
Six grand a month.
Yeah.
72 grand a year before the VAT. So if you add 20% to that, It's about 86, 87 grand. Quick maths. Don't fact check that.
It's great maths, by the way. Yeah.
And then if you were to have gone on to become a head of art design, what could they look to have earned?
So the best of the best would be getting somewhere like 600 a day.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mostly you'd be getting four to 500.
Okay.
So I got more than that if I was lucky, and I definitely pushed it. So I think towards the end I was trying to push the 400 mark as much as I possibly could.
Yeah.
Especially for smaller gigs where you know you're going to be in there for like 3 weeks, and it's like, well, then I'm going to nothing and I'm going to have to do this all again and find a new job. So yeah, towards the end it was trying to, but there would be no more. Like, it was kind of like, if I want to push on and earn more and have that regular, then I need to move on.
So just coming back to what you're saying, thank you for that as well. You mentioned the fact that, yeah, like it was really tough on your mental and like it still affects you to this day. How is it you're dealing with it, or how is it you dealt with it at the time, and was it leaving? And maybe it's like a nice time to talk about, you mentioned the fact that you're doing illustration in the evenings as well.
So the mental stuff, I mean, it just wasn't spoken. I know it sounds like I'm talking about something that was in the 80s, but it really wasn't something that you focus too much on. It, I mean, it's amazing how things have come on over the last 5 years, where how open you can be now, which is brilliant, and it really needs addressing more, especially in advertising. How I dealt with it, I didn't really know how to deal with it at the time. So, you know, there were times where I'd sit in a meeting and I'd be so nervous because advertising, it's funny, I was in a room with advertising creatives not long ago at a birthday, and I forgot how like overconfident you have to be, especially as a creative, and just loud. And it was like being in a room with comedians who were just like, hey, rah, rah, rah. And I was like, fuck, I can't deal with this. So yeah, for me, the mental stuff, I think it came later when there was a realization that, like, you know, I need to try and zone in. I need to address the fact that I can be quite anxious about stuff, and be okay with that and make my peace with it and find a way of dealing with it. But in the advertising days, it was just, I didn't know how to deal with it. And as a freelancer, especially, that there's no real, you don't get any support.
No.
So a couple of times when I had, you know, I would say sort of an anxiety attack at work. In fact, I remember one, it was towards the end of my time in advertising. We were doing a pitch for The Guardian, an agency, and it was really messy. I've never worked somewhere. There were like three different creative teams, all doing different ideas. There were like the project manager was somewhere else, so he had that no one had been briefed. So we were all just kind of doing our own thing. So he had all these ideas on this board, and I remember coming in the morning and someone high up, we're just watching him rip these all of the ideas down off of this board, like ripping them down, throwing them. And I remember saying to the designer next to me, like, we're gonna have a late one tonight, aren't we?
It reminds me a bit of Succession.
Yeah,
that's as you're talking, that's what's come into mind. Like a Logan Roy type character. Is advertising still like that? Like, do you know?
Well, yeah, that wasn't that. That was just before I left, so I would say definitely yes. Wow.
And to anybody who's thinking about getting into advertising, like, what would your advice be to them?
Well, I might have put them off. No, I think, you know, I've said some bad stuff about it, but it was great to me. When it was good, it was good. And it can be a fantastic career path. And we know people who've gone on, and friends of mine who still work in advertising are doing amazing work. And we know loads of people who've gone on to do a fantastic film and have good careers. But yeah, I think so. To get into advertising, it's, how would you do it? So you can intern, and that's a brilliant way of getting in. A lot of people that we know that interned at Saatchi in various places have gone on to do great careers. You don't necessarily need good grades or even really a degree. It's showing conceptually that you're showing a love for a craft, whether it's design or conceptual, and going in with pieces of work, and it's being different. So if you can find something unique to impress someone in that interview, then your chances will always be higher. So just turning up with a portfolio and talking through a couple of pieces of work you've done, I mean, whenever I was hiring, that was okay. You know, if you were an exceptionally good designer, then that was cool. But it's like going that extra mile. So coming up with something interesting, like the zines that I was talking about earlier, you know, that was a self-initiated project that opened some doors for me, because it wasn't just me showing, hey, I've done some design that someone's paid me to do. It's like, I love it. I love what I do. Yeah. And I'm doing it all the time. I'm trying to meet people and do cool stuff. And so that sort of thing, you know, self-initiated work is always a great way of breaking down the kind of barriers of that first interview.
I like it. And then, yeah, so illustration.
Yeah.
Yeah, you said that you were doing that in the evenings. Illustration, and what happens after you leave advertising?
So illustration, I've always loved. And my style changed, and obviously I was doing it for bands early on, and editorial illustration. And
what does illustration involve? Is it like drawing? Is it like poster design?
Yeah.
Is it book design? Magazine design? As you say, illustration. Yeah, I'm thinking like front covers and stuff like that.
Yeah, we did some front covers for sure. So it was always digital design, kind of collage based, vector based illustration, I would say. So lots of colors and geometry and things like that. That was kind of what I loved doing. And yeah, it was, we would do anything. Yeah, magazine designs, book covers, album sleeves. It was the stuff that I dreamed of doing when I was younger, right? Nice. The reality was, it's very hard to make a living.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, some people do amazingly, by the way. But I think my style came at a time where it was very easily replicated by people. And so you were quite... So that one of the reasons I got into advertising was I thought... So I got offered I signed up to loads of recruiters and showed people my portfolio, which was very illustrative heavy. And realized that that's not what recruiters wanted to see. Mm. They wanted to see ad work. They wanted to see that you can go in and take a brief and just do whatever branded stuff is. But again, it was one person who was a bit more creative as a recruiter took a chance on me. And there was a bit more of an illustrative brief at the time. God, I forget, it was like 02 or something like that. And it was... just a digital design, but that as soon as I got one, it snowballed, because then I could say, well, I did this O2 ad for whatever agency, and then other recruiters would. So it's one of those things where once you do something once, it's a lot easier to do it another time, because people have that trust. Even if it didn't go great, you can just sell it as, obviously, it went brilliantly. But so the illustration was, as I was doing advertising, was I thought this could be a really great way to infiltrate advertising from the inside. So if you're an illustrator, mainly you want to get an ad. You want to get a big ad job, because that's where the money is, and that's where you become a slightly more famous for being an illustrator. And so you can do editorial, you can do music, you can do all this cool stuff, but it's the ads that you really want to get. And it's really hard, because there's only a certain amount of ads that require illustration. So it's a very small pool to swim in. But I thought if I could keep doing freelance design, I could meet enough people in advertising so that when those opportunities came up to do illustration for advertising, then I'd know the right people. But actually, ironically, it did work. I got to know all the right people, but because they knew me as a, the perception of me was, you're Gordon, the freelance designer, I never quite got the same opportunities as someone else who was just an illustrator.
Okay.
It was kind of that perception, like how you sell yourself. So illustration was something that I did for years on the side.
Okay.
I mean, I had an agent, I had agents and all sorts of stuff. And, you know, we did some cool stuff, but yeah, I think there was that time where it was like, right, I don't want to do freelance advertising anymore because I want to push on with my life. You know, I want to settle down. And
so what is it you did go into after that?
Well, that's when I started Middle Boop as a proper company.
Okay. Okay. So 2.0.
Yeah. Yeah. Phase two.
Yeah. Okay.
Again, there was a point where it was like, I can use some really cool illustrative skills, and you work direct with clients as an illustrator. So I'd learned for years how to compose yourself into a client-based situation, like how to encourage someone who is corporate to give you a creative brief and what you need to sort of tease the right information out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I really loved branding. I really loved working with brands direct because you get to see your impact and your value.
Mm-hmm.
And get that, you know, get that value across to the brand, and you get to see it all kind of happen. So it was around that time where I thought, well, I know so much about kind of the strategy side of things because I've learned in advertising.
Mm-hmm.
I can apply my way of working with clients and even that illustrative style into a kind of branding package. And also I just noticed that in advertising, you so rarely get to interact with a client.
Mm-hmm.
and learn. Like, the brief that you get is usually about fourth hand. So to really use your skills to make an impact for that brand is almost impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't immerse yourself in that problem that they're trying to solve with the ad that they want to run. So I thought I could set up more of a boutique-style studio where we would work directly with startups. Like, I was really big into the kind of FMCG game at the time. You know, living in Hackney still, I mean, there was so many cool, like, kombucha brands and craft beer and coffee shops.
And for those who don't know, FMCG?
It's fast-moving consumer goods.
There we go.
It's a good test.
Yeah. So, okay, you've kind of touched upon it there. But, yeah, how would you describe, Middle Boop as an agency? So you've mentioned that, yeah, you partner with smaller businesses, but yeah, how would you just define Middle Boop?
So we're an agile studio, which basically means so it's me and my creative partner full time, and the rest of us are freelance. And we, you know, I've got a great pool of contacts that I've had for years through my freelance world and my learnings, and I build bespoke teams for each project. So right now we're talking to a jelly brand that needs rebranding, and they're in Waitrose, Whole Foods, a couple of places. They need a copywriter. They need a bit of strategy. They need a developer at the end of it. So we build a team like that. So I think the initial phase of Middle Boop was pretty much just me and maybe a copywriter or maybe another designer. And as I went through that process of a couple of years of learning what clients really needed, building out the level of services. And now we do everything nose to tail. So I think one of the biggest issues I found with working with clients was if we were doing branding, we would build the brand, we'd build the concept, we'd get them speaking in the right way, we'd learn all about their demographic, launch it, but then someone else would market them.
Without understanding your tone of voice and things like that.
Exactly, yeah. And I just thought, well, I'm all about building longer term relationships rather than the kind of hump and dump approach of, I suppose, maybe the advertising world, where you kind of just do a brief and then you move on. And, you know, we're in a really lucky position now that if we take clients on, it's because we genuinely believe in what they're trying to do, or we see something that a real problem that they're trying to solve. And
what is your approach to, what was your initial approach to getting clients? because obviously you went from having this job, you were there for, you know, many years, you go out on your own, you mentioned the fact that, you know, you're thinking about starting a family, this, that and the other. I suppose there's two questions there. What were the considerations before, you know, going all in on the agency? And then, yeah, how is it you went about winning those initial clients?
So the considerations were, if I don't do this now, then I could end up just being in freelance advertising for forever, relying on that. And I just thought, I need to cut this. I need to stop it. And so I'd set things up on the side. I'd set the business up. And it was at that point where, again, it was before really you would do remote working as much as we do now. So we would make connections with certain clients who'd need things, maybe a rebrand or a repackaging or whatever, but I'd be stuck in an agency somewhere. So they'd say, oh, come down to the office tomorrow and we'll have a meeting. You're like, well, I can't do it. Mm. So you'd lose these gigs. So it was like, right, I just need to stop. I need to stop this. I hate it. So the considerations were like, do I have enough cash in the bank to float this? Like if it doesn't click. And that was kind of it. It really was just like, I want to do it. And
so I'm just like distilling this, because to anybody who's like working a job and potentially wants to start their own thing,
yeah,
you made sure you had enough money in the bank. You kind of had some opportunities lined up. So you didn't like just leave with no plan. There was like a little bit of a plan. And then you took the plunge and figured the rest out.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been, yeah, you say yes and figure it out.
Yeah. I'm very similar.
You've got to do it.
I think sometimes until you say yes, and like you're not going to stimulate yourself. Even when I think about starting this podcast, I just booked the studio. Because if you don't book the studio, you're going to be procrastinating. Oh, what's the name? What am I going to discuss? So sometimes taking the first step is just the hardest. And for you, like the hardest step was just leaving that job, getting out of it, and then figuring the rest out after.
Absolutely. Yeah, you've said it very well. It was all of that. And it was just, yeah, I think I knew I had enough in the tank to kind of pay the rent at the time
and
keep us going. But yeah, it was just using those approaches, I guess, at the start of my career, just emailing, phoning people, trying to kind of hustle. And we did, at the start, I mean, I took a real hit on finances that year. And it would be, I would use a couple, there were a couple of jobs platforms. There was like Upwork. There was some way on Upwork, which is a good site to look for freelance work. You could kind of do a premium service where the budgets were sort of semi okay. So I tried that route. There were loads of different avenues that we tried early on, and it was more about just doing work. It's that perception again that I was talking about. So I really needed to shake that perception of me being a freelance designer and illustrator. It's kind of, again, it's that evolving. You know, I think for me in my career, it's constantly evolving. You're always learning something new, and you're always moving in a new direction. I think it's really important to keep pivoting.
Yeah, and how is it you like? So I hear that. So you leave, you burn the ships, as they say. How is it you go about getting those first clients? Is it you do more free? Is it through those websites you're posting and getting those initial jobs?
I tell you, I did anything. I even answered an ad. I was on Brick Lane and someone had put these posters up looking for a graphic designer to do our branding for a bakery, actually. And they apparently had hundreds of people, but I phoned them up and we just spoke about things. And That first 6 months was really tough because I was still learning. I lost a lot of gigs and they were important. It was important that I lost those because I was really able to... I think what I did, I feel like I did well, was learn from every time that we didn't win something and try and question why that didn't happen. And so we were up early on for a beer brand, which is now actually quite a big beer brand. And they were just transitioning from being really a startup to a scale up. And they'd had funding, and it was like the perfect brief for someone like me and my guys. And we didn't win it. And they went with someone a lot bigger. But of course, it made complete sense, because those guys were much more trusted. They worked with beer brands before. They could sell it in more.
For someone who's listening to this, and actually, I'll scratch that. Like, knowing what you know now,
yeah.
If you met yourself at that time, what advice would you give yourself to... what is something you wish you knew at that time?
Oh, speak the language of the people you're talking to.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is, so where things really changed for us, and there was a real catalyst moment, is I realized, and I think a lot of design studios do this, which is great for me now because we don't do it, is you will go into a meeting with someone, whoever, whether it's a founder of a drinks brand or a marketeer for a larger corporate, and you'll talk about design and what your design can do. These guys, they don't know. They don't care about kerning or leading, which is their typography terminology. They want to know about how your artwork can improve their KPIs, mm-hmm. you know, or can solve their KPIs for the year, or improve their overall return on investment that they've spent on you. They want to know, like, how can you as a business help solve certain problems, especially as founders where money's tight, and so they need to know that they're really getting value. So it was a really interesting time, and basically I hired a new business partner, Grey Matters, brilliant. And new business is a bit of a dirty word, because I think you expect new business, you expect people to do cold calling and phone up loads of brands and businesses, and it's a terrible way of doing things. I don't think it works, because what are the chances of your exact needs, what your exact talent being met with someone who needs that exact thing? So this guy is all about, like, he would audit your business. So we would do a holistic audit of our business, our website, our decks that we, creds decks that we sent out to people. And he would say, you're talking as a designer, like, but you need to talk like you know what you're talking about if you want to meet a marketeer and talk in their language. So I took about a month, sit down and learn, you know, what would a founder really want to talk about? So what are their day-to-day problems for an FMCG, for a drinks brand? Well, it might be something to do with their supply chain or their fulfillment. It might be the packaging doesn't quite work for, you know, somewhere in shipping it's breaking down. They might be spending too much money on their performance advertising. So I learned a lot of acronyms, about, like, marketing acronyms and kind of how founders would talk. And honestly, it was just like we started winning stuff. It was within a couple of months, we went from working with very small brands who were startups or just becoming a scale up, to working with, like, some of the biggest global brands in the world.
Wow.
I'm pretty convinced that if I hadn't learned how to speak a little bit more, kind of take myself out of my own world,
yeah,
and realize, actually, how can we use creative and design as a real tool to add value to these different brands and different marketeers, that I wouldn't have won those later gigs.
So I love that, and that's, like, a great takeaway, like, speak the language. To somebody who's listening to this and they're like, how is it I can go about learning, you know, the language of, you know, CEOs, marketeers, what is it you actually did to learn the language you needed to speak?
So I read some great books. There's some amazing websites that just have, it literally breaks down all of the, because there's so many acronyms out there, especially in marketing. And I used to have bookmarks. So if I was doing a Zoom call, I'd have the bookmarks open on my as a tab, and just in case
you needed to reel them off.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And I just started reading really good strategy books. There's a great guy called Marty Neumeier who was actually similar to me in the way that he used design. He was a designer, and then he realized in order to kind of push on and stop just being a designer and really help brands, he needed to see the business side and how important that was and the strategy. So his books and talks are fantastic for, I suppose, bridging that specific gap between design and business. Mm-hmm. But there's loads. There's some great marketeers. Seth Godin, I think, is a fantastic marketeer. He does some great talks. Yeah, I spent a lot of time kind of digesting.
I love it.
The world outside of design.
And then you start winning these. You start winning these pitches. Yeah, like, you know, you touched upon it in advertising, but now as your own agency, what are some of the brands that you start winning these pitches for?
So Unilever was the big one. Mm. They're still a client of ours 5.5 years later.
Wow.
Which is, yeah, was a big catalyst moment. So, and it came about, again, I think it goes back to your earlier question, like how did you start getting things, these opportunities? I was saying about talking, but it was almost like that perception and the fact that I was basically talking to anyone that I knew at the time. I would be, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm doing branding. We're trying to help people. We've got these packages for startups. We're trying to grow businesses. And so it was like a friend of a friend that I'd had a conversation with months before. Mm-hmm. The friend of the friend worked for Unilever. He phoned me up. Just completely out of the blue. And this is odd for me because I'm not used to people coming to me. I'm very much used to going out there
winning business.
Yeah, and like forcing people to work with me in some respects. You know, it's kind of, I think some people, I used to see talks and people would be like, oh yeah, and then I did this great job and then I did that, and you'd always be like, how?
Yeah.
And for me it was always knocking on doors and trying any different way that I could, that I thought would work. But yeah, this one literally came from a conversation. And I mean, fair play, he's a friend now. He doesn't work there. He works for Tony's Chocolate Only now, actually. Mm-hmm. The guy Mark Howard, who's a brilliant marketeer, and the clue's in the name, I suppose. And he had spoken, he said, to about 20 different big agencies to freelance designers, and we got in a chat. They were branding a new brand that Unilever were launching, and we ended up speaking about fulfillment and supply chain, and like, how are you sourcing these products, how are they made, what's it going on there, what's the story that we can build, how can we build our community around this product. And he basically, yeah, after I won the gig, he said, yeah, you were the only guy that
asked those questions.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Everyone else spoke about
what design. They can do, design. Yeah. And that's, yeah. And you've taken that forward with all of the pitches and stuff that you've done since.
Yeah, for sure. That's very much part of our process now. So when we speak to any new client, it's, you know, we want to know the
end-to-end process.
Exactly.
So you can, because maybe there's a story within the story,
yeah,
that differentiates you from being just another chocolate brand, if we're taking Tony's Chocolate Only,
yeah,
as an example, or for Unilever. I know they've got loads of healthcare products. All right, so you're in the groove, and then talk to me about the Weird World Cup and like how that, where does that fit into this story?
I'm not sure it does fit in anywhere, to be honest. But so I tell you what, it was not a million miles from where we're sat now. It's 2018 was the first one. We did two. So we did the Weird World Cup and the Weird Euros 4 years later. And I think at the time, I'd done a lot of heavy corporate client work and was looking for an outlet. Like, I wanted to engage again with a more of a creative community. Again, coming from that illustration background, you meet some awesome people who are doing cool stuff. And The World Cup was not a million miles away. I was down the pub with a guy, and we were sort of spitballing ideas. We were like, we should do something to commemorate this World Cup. We should try and get some artists together and do something. But like, you know, talking about that USP just then, with every brand needs its USP, we were like, well, what would our thing be? Because you can't do a poster. Everyone does posters. It's boring. Like, what product is like synonymous with watching football in a pub? Like that's kind of retro. And so I had a beer mat in my hand, and we were kind of, it was the other guy who was like, he was interning for me at the time. He was like, that's cool. There's something in this idea, you know, this beer mat. So as the night progressed, we were saying, well, wouldn't it be funny if we got these like really interesting artists to have like create some artwork on a beer mat, a coaster, and wouldn't it be funny if they ended up in pubs and like punters were just resting their beer on like a David Trigley piece of work but we still needed that hook. So we had our idea. We were like, we'll get creatives to put work on a beer mat, but what? And you know, again, you couldn't do that cliche like top 10 best goals or something like that. It needed to be funny. It needed to be tongue in cheek. And we happened to be talking about some of the cult moments in football. It's weird things that
happened.
Yeah, yep. that are talked about on WhatsApp groups with people all over the world.
Yeah.
Remember the moment when Diana Ross missed the penalty in 94 and all these just funny little moments. And that was it. It was kind of everything came together with that idea. We were like, I thought it would be really cool to do this for a charity too. And I'd heard of Football Beyond Borders at the time. And so basically I phoned up Jasper, I found his number from, again, finding people's numbers. And so this was actually the most nervous I was when starting this project. It wasn't asking these artists if they could spare their time, because I knew people would be up for it. I thought it was a cool idea. I was phoning Jasper because I really wanted to work with them. Because I thought we could build these beer mats and sell them and use the money to help this charity. I remember phoning Jasper up and was like trying to explain this idea. And he goes... Jasper is the founder of FBB, who you know as well.
Loosely.
And he was really quiet for a moment, and he was like, "So you're going to sell some artwork and give us money?"
long and short.
Yeah, I was like, "Yeah, basically, like, would you be up for it?" He's like, "Yeah." And that was it. The idea was born. So we had our charity, and through my network of illustrators that I knew and creatives, we found really varied people from all different walks of life to come up with some artwork.
How much did you end up raising?
Thousands.
Love it.
I think the first one was $3,000 or $4,000, I think, wow, in the end, maybe more. That went direct to Football Beyond Borders. They were down in Brixton at the time, and they were actually trying to raise money for a new hub. So they support young people. So young people who maybe are from a tough upbringing or haven't had the most opportunities in life, they use football as a way of engaging with these young people.
Yeah.
And they'll get people to come in and do talks on, you know, things like design or advertising or film production and have this network of basically having a safe space where people can come and express themselves and go on to do some cool things. And it's brilliant. I've met some amazing people through there. So yeah, we were able to use that money to go straight to their creative hub. Yeah.
And then like alongside that, I know, you know, with the success of your agency, it's led to you doing some talking globally. So yeah, like what are the kind of talks you deliver, and how is it those have come about?
So I've been speaking for years now, really. I had a bit of a hiatus for about a year or 2 years maybe, where we were just really busy with work, and I kind of felt like I needed a break from it. But We did. I mean, I did a tour talking about the weird World Cup, actually.
Oh, wow.
We did. I spoke in Manila. Spoke in Manila to like 5,000 people. Yeah. Mental. And it was... I remember speaking to a guy at that particular festival who had spoken a year before and saying, like, what's the capacity for this room? Like, a couple hundred people. And he was like, no, it's massive. Design in Darba in Cape Town. You've got to see some amazing places. And that all started, I mean, it goes back to this kind of phoning people up and emailing people. And so my first proper talk was at a conference in Amsterdam, and I needed a way in. I needed a story to get these founders of these events to trust that I might be able to come and deliver a good talk to people. And so the first one was, I actually forget the name of it now, but it was more of a tech conference. It was not long after I'd done that World Cup project, the Olympics project.
Oh, okay.
And so I said, look, I've done this. I've been part of this mad campaign. I've done this, that, and the other thing. And so that helped me a lot. That opened some doors. So I used the fact that I'd been part of this Olympics project to kind of get the first couple of talks.
If there's one thing I've learned from this conversation, it's the power of outbounding.
Yeah.
Like, the thread throughout this whole story is, and you did say it at the start, like, nothing is given to you. You have to go and, like, get everything. And I think you said that you learned that at college.
Yeah.
Through the experiences of not really being, like, that academic, but knowing that there was something there. And, like, the learnings that you've taken from that have kind of shaped your, like, entire career.
Yeah. Basically, yeah. 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 Those early days were, yeah.
No. I love it. Like, as we round out, like, to aspiring creatives, people who are, you know, and people who are trying to understand, like, their next step, what should they take away from this conversation? What would your advice be to them?
So for anyone, yeah, who's an aspiring creative, the takeaway, I guess, it seems like a lot of our conversation today has been about reaching out and not being afraid to do that. And you would be amazed who will reply to you. I think it's not always as done a thing as people may think. It's all about just creating those connections and putting yourself out there.
Agreed.
You know, I had a debate once with I was doing a talk, actually, a panel discussion with a design studio, a very stuffy design studio. And I remember saying it then, it was to students, and saying, you've just got to contact people. And like, when you have something that's worth talking about, sing from the rooftops about it. And this guy disagreed with me. He said, I couldn't disagree more. He said, we have, and I could never get his point, because he was saying, we just have this amazing work and we put it out there. And I'm like, I remember thinking, you're talking to students. Like, you've got PR people, you've got a whole team that are going to publicize this. Like, it's such a different thing. But I really think that kind of, I suppose it's a DIY approach of just reaching out to people, even a cold email, with a human aspect and element to it, with a real genuine feeling behind it, you'd be amazed at who responds. And yeah, I'm still doing it today. You know, I've literally just been asked to do an article for The Drum, just asking someone, you know, it's we got this podcast. I reached out to you because I like your podcast. I thought it'd be cool to tell the story. So yeah, I think it's all about that. And also, like, you don't have to settle.
Yeah.
You don't have to settle for a full-time job. You can do things yourself, and it's really hard. But, you know, if you have a bit of a vision and a plan, you can go out there and do really cool things.
Yeah. And, like, what would you say over the last, like, 15 or so years has been the biggest lesson you've learned?
Ooh. What's the biggest lesson I've learned? That's actually quite a tough question. What's the biggest lesson I've learned?
Okay, I'll give you another question. How has the industry changed in the 15 years that you've been working?
I'll answer both because I've got one. So one of the biggest lessons I've learned is always keep learning. I think there was a real time in my career when I was quite arrogant and I thought, I'm done here, like I'm good. And I forget what happened, but it really knocked my confidence. And I remember thinking, God, you've got, like, what? Why have I stood still for 6 months or however long, thinking that I know this? There's so much more that you can learn. And it's really important to, especially in the world we are today, things are harder. Budgets are tighter. It's harder to kind of push on. Right now, we're about to talk about the evolution of our industry. If you're not on top of things, if you're not evolving, then you'll get left behind. We're really at the pinnacle right now of creativity and AI coming in and products that are making design a lot easier than they used to be. If you're sat still as just a designer, then I don't know where your career is going to be in 10 years. It's going to be much harder.
Yeah.
But also, it's fun. I love the fact that I've evolved things over the years. And one thing that I've learned also really that has been important to me is lean into opportunities that they don't necessarily feel like the right thing at the time, but there's something in it that could be of benefit. If you lean into that, then yeah, you never quite know where you'll go.
I love it. Where do you see yourself in Midibook in the next five or so years?
Hopefully on a beach somewhere.
Yeah.
With a margarita and
relaxing. Taking time off.
Yeah, time off would be lovely.
I love it. And then, yeah, like, we've kind of touched upon it, but we have a closing tradition on this podcast. Like, with everything that you've learned, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give your younger self? And would you still be doing the same thing?
I think the advice I would give my younger self would be, what would I give myself? Chill. Everything's cool. Don't care so much. I used to care so much. I used to get so into career and you know, I'm nearly 40 and, you know, I've got a kid. I'm like, life is very, very different now. Mm. And I still love my work. I still care about my work, of course. But yeah, I don't let it, like, I don't go to sleep at night thinking about work anymore. I'm happier because of it.
Mm.
So there's, yeah. So I would say to my earlier self, yeah, run more, drink less, and just chill, because, you know, we're creating ads. It doesn't matter.
I love it. Gordon, where can people find you, learn more about the business?
So if you Google Middle Boop, BOOP, you will come up. So we're on Instagram. We've got a website. Yeah, there's loads. There's my talks are online on YouTube. We're on there. Connect with me on LinkedIn, anything.
Yeah, we'll whack it in the show notes. And to everybody who's gotten to this point in the podcast, you know what to do, guys. Please like, please subscribe, please share, please comment. Please let us know who you want to hear from next. At WMBFDpod. This has been another episode of What My Best Friend Does. If you didn't know, now you know. Over and out.